In rural America, one of the consequences of globalization is blight. Many buildings sit idle or in utter disrepair. There's no code enforcement to speak of. As long as the property owners pay their taxes, and those taxes are sometimes as little as a couple of $100 per year, as long as they pay that, they're permitted to hold their properties and bring down the value of everyone else's. Welcome to Bring Back the Bustle, a podcast about revitalizing rural America. I'm Siobhan Jones, your host. Today's episode is about combating rural blight to attract investment in rural America. If you reside in a major city, this next premise won't be unfamiliar to you. A function of local government is to ensure the safety and fitness for occupancy of real property. You know that. Municipalities are supposed to have a building code and they're supposed to enforce it. Small rural communities don't always follow these formalities. They don't always have even permitting requirements that you're accustomed to in larger cities. And if they do have standards on the books, they don't always enforce them. They allow attractive nuisances to exist on Main Street. A particularly egregious example, and this is a true story, is an historic mid-century movie theater in a rural town in Louisiana. The bones of the building are beautiful, a possible candidate for inclusion in the National Register of Historic Places. However, it has sat empty for 40 years. The roof and the foundation are missing, so there's no floor and no ceiling. Dozens of decades-old trees grow where the rows of theater seats once were. The theater lights and wires dangle from the marquee, whose wood is dry rotted. This is an extreme case. No one has entered the doors of that theater for at least 15 years, fearing the snakes that undoubtedly have made the forest that's inside their permanent home. While no one is entering this building, there are other abandoned buildings in rural towns all around the country, and they're a danger to the public. The unhoused and drug addicted often live in and or use drugs in abandoned buildings. Some of them have inadvertently burned down such buildings while using fire to keep warm or to light their drugs. Children sometimes like to hang out in abandoned buildings. These buildings may be infested with mold, asbestos, rats, snakes, and other dangerous animals or organisms. Older children may use the spaces to engage in truancy or in consensual or even non-consensual sex with other teens or children. Neighboring property owners are harmed as well. A potential tenant or buyer may shy away from a building surrounded by blight. They know the presence of vagrants will cause customers to second-guess doing business with them. They realize that they'll have to work harder to attract customers, and they'll need to spend money to keep the substance abusers from robbing them to feed that habit. And as a result, they will discount the offers that they're willing to make to the property owners. Finally, blight is incredibly expensive to a town. If the town looks run down, it's hard to attract investment. An empty building is not only lost tax revenues, but it is one less space for local residents to make productive use of. It's a visible sign of decline. Residents staring in the face of multiple barren buildings lose hope. Both the town and the people become stuck in a rut. So cracking down on rural blight can prevent these harms and allow rural towns to bounce back. What's the best way to crack down? First, understanding the causes and reasons for blight can help in establishing fair blight policies. The original or root cause of blight is usually changes in the economy. They lead to industry loss to that community. Job loss follows, population loss after that, And then the exodus of small business tenants from the town. So there's no one to rent those buildings and put businesses in them anymore. So that's the reason that, or those are the reasons that blight starts. But the reason that blight becomes insidious is usually the owner's lack of resources to maintain the property. See, no owner wants their property to sit empty or to fall into disrepair. The owner understands that one problem leads to another. A leaky roof leads to mold. That leads to dry rot and a crumbling infrastructure. Then you only have a frame that you have to work with and you end up needing a gut renovation. So if they could arrest the problem early, after the early signs of decline, they would. They wouldn't allow the situation to take hold if the resources were available to prevent it. So if they don't have any money to make repairs and they don't have any tenants, why don't they just sell the property, you might ask? Well, they don't have to, because remember, I said taxes were low in these rural towns, so it doesn't cost much to hold the property. And if there are no formal code enforcement policies in place, then no one from the city is bothering you, and the condition just is permitted to remain. Now, in major cities, neighbors complain about their property values, and it leads to some action by the government. But the government doesn't always get it right. As an example, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's 2008 so-called Abandoned and Blighted Property Conservatorship Act is a law that goes too far. It turns everyday citizens into bounty hunters. When they identify blighted property, they have standing to go to court and get themselves appointed the conservator of the property, purportedly to make repairs. Those repairs and the legal fees for the court action are then charged back against the property. When the neglectful owner can't pay the fees, the legal fees and the repair costs, the property is sold, often to an investor who backed the conservator's legal action from the get-go. The neglectful, now former owner's equity in the property is then turned over to the conservator as a reimbursement for the repairs and legal fees incurred. Let's pause for a second and take that in. A property owner has to pay the legal fees to take his own property from him or her. If the owner opts to fight the conservatorship in court, they also have to pay their own lawyer. So someone who didn't have enough money to make repairs now has two sets of attorney's fees tacked on to the cost of those repairs. Think about a third party making repairs that they ultimately are not financially responsible for. Do they run around getting multiple quotes so that they can get the best price for those repairs? No. In fact, Pennsylvania ensures that the conservatorship does just the opposite, or that the conservator does just the opposite. The law marks up the cost of the repairs by 20% and awards that 20% markup to the conservator once the property is sold. So the conservator is incentivized to make the property as beautiful and attractive as possible, because they're now the new owner who's going to get the benefit of those repairs at some point down the line. This system is ripe for these and other abuses that a University of Pennsylvania professor, Kara McClellan, says are robbing low-income people of color of their homes and of the equity in them. The data that Professor McClellan points to suggests that developers are using this law to further gentrification. Gentrification isn't limited to large cities like Philadelphia. It's possible in small towns as well. And the effects of gentrification in a small town are even more damaging to residents. While a Philadelphia resident can move to a rural town, there's no place else for rural residents to go in the face of gentrification, since they're already in the lowest cost area. Therefore, it's important that a town maintain a healthy balance among the owner, the town itself, and the investor who wants to develop blighted buildings. Towns need reasonable building codes to protect the owner of the blighted property and the property values of nearby parcels, as well as to encourage development and economic growth. There are Main Street Community Development Guidelines that a town can use as a baseline for establishing fair standards, whether or not the town is a participant in the nationwide Main Street program. Carrot and stick programs tend to be the most favorable to local owners to help them stay in deals when outside investors come in. From a carrot standpoint, if the town has local, state, or federal resources, the town can consider providing grants or other incentives to property owners for use in the repair of their property. Of course, the carrot approach may not work if the property is too far gone. No town should be rebuilding or completely rehabbing a building for an owner. Plus, residents who use their own money to maintain their properties may resent that others are being given money for such a upkeep. So you have to convince those who do not get an incentive that the increase in their property value that's brought about by fixing the neighbor's dilapidated property is like an indirect subsidy to them. Now, if despite the availability of a carrot, a property owner is still unable or unwilling to bring their property up to code and won't sell it at a reasonable price, the town needs to apply the stick at this point. Impose code enforcement liens, fines that accumulate for as long as the hazard persists. If the property owner fails to clear the code enforcement liens, the town should sell the property to the highest bidder and give any equity to the pre-sale owner. The same way in a foreclosure, if there's equity in your property after it gets foreclosed and all the other costs of sale are paid, then the homeowner gets that equity. That is a much fairer system than what exists in Pennsylvania, where they're deputizing neighbors against neighbors in search of a quick buck. Back in Philadelphia, which has the highest incidence of enforcement of Pennsylvania's takings law, a couple of citizens have turned conservatorships into businesses. They earn the largest of either $2,500, a 20% markup on repair cost, or 20% of the sales proceeds on each property. In practice, since the conservator isn't the one actually making the repairs, it's this investor who's in the background who's making those repairs, the 20% markup on repairs goes to that investor, right? And the conservator also doesn't get the 20% of the sales proceeds because the sales proceeds are usually very low. There are few bidders at a foreclosure sale for a building that looks like it needs to be knocked down, right? So this conservator only gets about $2,500 in these instances. They bring about 60 such cases a year on average in Philadelphia. So these conservator plaintiffs are ending up splitting about $150,000 a year. The conservator plaintiffs are often people of color themselves, and they're robbing other minorities of their wealth for a few pennies. They don't even become property owners themselves in the process. So the carrot and stick incentive program that I mentioned earlier, with a code enforcement as the stick and incentives as the carrot, is a much better system. Bottom line, if your town looks run down, it's hard to attract investment. Investors will be more likely to invest in rural towns if the towns have building ordinances and if the town enforces them. An enforcement system doesn't necessarily have to harm local property owners. As we discussed in our episode entitled How to Rehab Rural Downtown Communities, long-term property owners can benefit from historic buildings. They can share in the economic growth spurred by new investment. Instead of getting pushed out, historic buildings can help them monetize long, non-performing assets. However, if a particular owner doesn't want to be a good neighbor, the town should stand ready to support the other property owners who are maintaining their properties and contributing jobs and good energy to the community. The town needs a process for combating rural blight that is fair to all stakeholders. Local politicians should balance incentives with an enforcement mechanism. So establish an economic development program, pass an ordinance, and enforce it. That's it. Now, as usual, there are several links in the transcript to this podcast. If you want to listen to that prior episode I mentioned, How to Rehab Rural Downtown Communities, there's a link for that. And that episode is a bit old, so it's no longer in our 10-episode feed. So you need the link, I think, to access it. If you want to know more about Professor McClellan's research findings and analysis, there's a link for that as well. So go to the site and go to podcast on the menu. The site is ruralqrof.com. QROF means Qualified Rural Opportunity Fund. So go to that website and you will find the transcripts to the podcast, and there are links to the support for much of what was discussed in this podcast. I'm Siobhan Jones. I'm looking forward to meeting again next week, and I hope you are as well.